So last week I started what I hope to be a six-week series on conventionally or commonly in our tradition is called the five precepts. However, the word to translate it as the five precepts maybe it's a little bit unfortunate. The word the common word for it is panchasila. The five sila means virtue, so it's the five virtues. But it's also the same list is called the Pancha Sikapadas, which is the five training precepts. So these five virtues or five training precepts are conventionally, again, it's said not to kill and not to take what's not given, not to engage in improper sexuality, not to engage in lying, not to engage in intoxicants. And these are kind of one of the very important foundations for Buddhist spirituality for lay people. People who are monks are basically expected to follow these as well, and often much more strictly, but they will do so with many other training precepts, many other rules that they have to live by, train by. One of the differences for monastics is that the third precept, the precept of no illicit or inappropriate sexuality, sexual activity, is a precept or a training rule of celibacy for the monastics. So today, last week was more the introduction to this, and today I want to talk about the first virtue. And the first virtue is in Pali, the ancient Buddhist language. Goes as a training precept goes panatipata vera mani sikapadam samadhiyami, and which goes means panatipata means panya here means breathing, like anapanasati, anapana. So it's for any beings that breathe, I undertake the training precept of not striking at them, striking out at them, not physically hitting them, striking them. This is universally translated into English, or universally understood by the tradition, to mean not to kill. But by extension, it also means not to cause physical harm, intentional physical harm, to any being that breathes. So, worms breathe, supposedly, and fish, and birds, and any kind of animal that breathes, including human beings. It seems that in the ancient Buddhist understanding of life, plants don't breathe in the same way. So the training precept doesn't apply directly to plants. To be born as a breathing being, and even more so to be born as a human being, is considered in Buddhism to be a very rare event. Many of you know that Buddhism believes in rebirth, and so you have this endless round of rebirth that people get born, beings get born, they die, they get born again. And being reborn as a human being is a pretty rare event. And it's pretty, it's people who are biologists and realize how many creatures there are just inhabiting this world. It's only a small percentage of them that are human beings, even though nowadays they have the biggest impact, maybe, most obviously. But the chances of being born a human being are said to be the same chances of a blind turtle swimming out in the ocean. And that a blind turtle that once every 100 years surfaces, the chances of that blind turtle surfacing once every 100 years and poking its head up through a log that has a hole in it, that's floating on the ocean, that's the chances you have of, being born as a human being. So it's considered very rare. Maybe you have a better chance winning the California lottery. And this kind of teaching about the rarity of human birth is meant to be is conveyed so we understand how precious and valuable human birth is, both so that we take our own human birth quite seriously. It's a rare event to be born as a human being, and so we should take it seriously and do well with it, use it well. There are opportunities in human life that exist in human life much better than any other form of life that you might take. So while you're a human being, you might as well take advantage of these opportunities. In particular, those opportunities to cultivate a spiritual life, or those opportunities to cultivate a life of liberation. So on one hand, the teachings of the rarity of human life is to encourage us to use this life well. The other aspect of this is that to realize how precious life is at all, so that everyone you see around you here in this room is also very precious. They have been born into a very rare occurrence in the universe. They've been born as a human being. For people who don't believe in the Buddhist idea of rebirth, and there are certainly many Buddhists who don't, for those people who don't believe in it, then you'd have to say the chances of being born as a human being have seemed rare than that little turtle. I mean, you basically had one chance. At least with rebirth, you get, you know, you know, if you blew it once, you get next time you get to try again. So to be born, human life and any life at all is considered very precious. Any kind of life is a life that it's possible to have empathy for or with. So one of the ways a human being seems to have been created, at least most human beings, is with some capacity for empathy. There are certainly people who don't seem to have it, but generally, the generic person is born with the capacity for empathy. And given the right conditions, we'll feel a tremendous amount of empathy. Some people feel it for the ones who are closest to them. They feel it for their family, perhaps. Some people feel it for their neighbors or for their, you know, people who they know close by. Some people have the capacity to feel it for strangers, for distant strangers. People feel it for people far away. But we have this capacity for empathy. And some of the conditions for the arising of empathy is being present, is being mindful. When the mind is distracted, when we're caught up in the busyness of life, the ambitions of life, our anxieties of life, our worries, our planning of life, sometimes there's not enough space in our attention to allow us to take in the experiences of life, the experiences of other people, in such a way that it triggers or vibrates that part of us that is empathic. The word compassion, the word karuna, is called the trembling of the heart in contact with suffering in the world. Some kind of trembling, some kind of vibration, some kind of you know, resonance that we have inside of ourselves in contact with suffering in the world. When there's joy in the world, empathy takes the form of happiness or joy, a sympathetic joy it's called. So we have a capacity for empathy. And we have a capacity of covering over that empathy, of not living in touch with it. When we practice mindfulness, it's a practice which will tend to open up or release that capacity for empathy, because mindfulness is to be present, is to open up the doors of attention, so attention is open and clear and not covered over, not preoccupied, not lost to ourselves, but rather open and available to take in the experiences of the world. And in that kind of condition, empathy has the best chances of arising and happening for us. This kind of empathy in Buddhism is assumed. There's no theological or dharmological, buddhological explanation of why human beings are this way. It's just that's the way they are. It seems to be, at least some of them are that way. So it doesn't have to be justified. There's no elaborate attempt to try to justify why you should have empathy. I mean, you could. It's not that difficult. But it's just assumed that it's there. And because of that empathy, then there's a kind of encouragement with that empathy to kind of put yourself in other people's shoes. And one of the classic exercises for empathy in Buddhism is to realize that you have, hopefully realize that you have a desire or wish for your own happiness. And just as you would like happiness, so other people would like happiness as well. So you use yourself as an example to understand other people. So you have to understand, you have to know yourself well. So again, this mindfulness practice is very important, where there's a certain degree of self-understanding and knowledge. We understand ourselves. And some of the things we understand about ourselves allows ourselves to understand other people better. Just as when we love ourselves well, very important Buddhist virtue is the capacity to have self-love, it's a lot easier to discover how to love other people. Capacity to happiness for ourselves, it's easier to imagine that possibility for other people. And so it opens up those doors of empathy, that exercise, to put ourselves in other people's shoes. So with this empathy and with putting ourselves in other people's shoes, Buddhism then puts a tremendous importance on the first precept, which is the precept not to kill. And it's kind of like cardinal precept. In the first recorded contact of Buddhism with the West, as far as I know, there was a Greek king, maybe one or two centuries before Christ, who met a Buddhist monk. The king's name was Malinda, and the monk's name was Nagasena. And they had a long debate and discussion. The king asked all these kinds of questions. It's a Greek king. And one of the things that this Buddhist monk told the Greek king, he said, I'll paraphrase, I don't remember exactly what it was, but he said, the primary characteristic of the Buddha's teaching, of Buddhism, is non-violence, is non-harming. The primary characteristic of the Buddha Dharma is non-harming. That's quite a strong kind of, you know, thing to say about the value of non-harming in Buddhism. And one of the things you could argue or try to explain is that the practice of liberation, practice of freedom, of mindfulness, is a practice of learning how not to cause harm to ourselves and harm to the world around us. So it's kind of like the cardinal virtue of Buddhism, not to kill. It's also considered to be a wonderful and very important gift that we give to the world. It's a form of generosity to create the conditions through our own behavior where no one has any reason to fear us. And no one has any, create the conditions so people feel safe around us. So to know that people, know in the world there are people who are dedicated to non-violence, to non-harming, I think is very helpful and very encouraging. I met a few weeks ago Aryaratna, who was is the Gandhi of Sri Lanka. And it was awesome to meet this man who's dedicated himself to nonviolence and to do it in a grassroots way to organize people across ethnic divides in Sri Lanka so that people who often are fighting each other have become friends and learn how to work together in Sri Lanka. His organization's Sarvodaya was recently given an award by United Nations as the most effective non-governmental agency to respond to the tsunami in January, December. And they had people starting to organize within 3 hours of the tsunami. And one of the things that made them very effective was they had members in all the different ethnic communities in Sri Lanka. They could be able to cross across boundaries that often, you know, there's soldiers, you know, facing each other because of the civil war there. So this man, you know, is a great exemplar in the modern world of someone who's living a life of nonviolence. I give you one example. I told the story recently. I hope it wasn't Monday night. He's not universally loved in Sri Lanka, but he's also is very famous, and his point of view, his opinions, is highly respected also. And he was in America just now because visiting because they're about to have a presidential election in Sri Lanka. And he said that if he stays in Sri Lanka, the various candidates will call him up and ask for an endorsement. And it puts him in a situation where he can't say yes and he can't say no. So the solution is not to be in Sri Lanka. And so he's off kind of hiding in America until the election's over. But he tells a story of housing a large family of Tamils. And the Buddhist Sri Lankans were often, you know, in civil war with the Tamils, a lot of animosity. And he'd taken in a large group of a large family, and they were living in his house. And a large group of Buddhist Sri Lankans came to his house, kind of a gang, big gang, kind of, you know, came lynching gang, came to kind of do something to those, that family that was there, something violent. And the only person home in his family that day was his 17-year-old daughter. And these guys came to the door and wanted to come in and, I don't know, cause some violence. And she stood there and said, you know, if my father was home, you would only be able to get to these Tamils over his dead body. But he's not home. If my mother was home, you'd only be able to get to the Tamil family over her dead body. But she's not home. I'm the one who's home. It's only if you kill me first can you get to them. And so they left. Isn't that a nice story? 17-year-old girl, raised, I imagine, in principles of nonviolence. And that's what she did. So the idea of nonviolence, I think, is a primary characteristic of Buddhism. Anybody who considers themselves a Buddhist needs to take this virtue, this precept, this characteristic of Buddhism very, very seriously. Not necessarily a moralistic way, but here it kind of feeds back on the meditation practice, a practice that we do ourselves. When we look at these virtues or these precepts, these training precepts, one of the things we're looking at is what is the impulse inside of us, inside of ourselves, that would break these precepts, that would do the opposite activity? What is the impulse inside of us that would kill? What is that like? And if we're really honest with that impulse, chances are you'd find things which are not necessarily exemplary for who you know, exemplary motives. Chances are when you see the motive to want to kill, to cause physical harm, you probably find, chances are with human beings, you probably find a fair percentage of those humans will have hate. A fair percentage will be greed. A fair percentage will be fear motivated. A variety of very strong motivations, and probably name a few others. Those are the very forces in our own psyche that Buddhist practice is meant to work to release us from. Help us release us from hate, from greed, from fear. So the working with these precepts is a chance to look in deeply at these very impulses that the practice is trying to get at. And so some people use these training precepts as a mirror to help them understand themselves more deeply, more clearly. When you feel the impulse to kill, to look, oh, stop, don't just do that, to stop and turn around, what's really going on here? What's really happening deep inside? To try to be extremely honest about that. When we act on those impulses, then we're acting from places of delusion, we're acting from places of attachment, we're acting from places where we're clouding over, coloring over, our innate beauty, this precious beauty, this precious, precious empathy, freedom, openness, peace that's possible to have in our own hearts. So to want to hurt someone physically, or to want to hurt someone at all, goes directly counter to that movement that we're trying to cultivate through meditation practice, through Buddhist practice. We're trying to cultivate a practice of greater sensitivity. To kill or cause harm is to become insensitive. You have to be insensitive to some degree in order to want to harm someone. So Buddhists, you know, when they try to live by this virtue, are trying to negotiate or trying to understand or work on or reflect on or understand themselves in a much more deeper way to help with the purification process of what covers the innate possibility of freedom in our own hearts. So this is all very good. Certainly it's good to live, to want to be dedicated to nonviolence. But then comes our real lives, right? How does this apply to our real lives? And I've heard of people say, well, the monastics, those monks and nuns, they live in saffron towers. And, you know, they're removed from everyday life, and they have these really strict rules, and it's black and white for them, and what do they know about, you know, the kind of issues that lay people have to face? And sometimes, in fact, if you go to try to talk about some of the ethical issues with monastics, sometimes they won't even answer you. They don't want to engage occasionally in some of the very thorny or difficult dilemmas that might exist in life. Today I was talking to one Buddhist monk and going to be talking about this first precept. I was asking some questions around his take, and I brought up the issue of abortion. And basically he didn't want to, you know, he was very clear, you know, abortion is breaking the first precept. But to try to engage and, you know, well, you know, but when, you know, he wasn't interested in talking about it. Just hands off kind of question. Mm-hmm. So, but in our daily life, how do we negotiate this precept? What does it mean for us? I suspect very few of you are engaged in activities that involve killing other people. What about killing animals? Are any of you butchers? I haven't met many butchers in my life, and I have never met one at IMC. So there might be the one of you is a butcher, but chances are there's not a lot of slaughterhouses nearby. Maybe some of you are hunters. That's more likely. Maybe some of you hunt. Some of you might fish. And is that breaking the precept? How do you relate to that? In places like Thailand, there are people whose professions are hunting and fishing, and Buddhists, and they'll feel that this is not appropriate activity for Buddhists to do, but this is their profession. They say, I'm making bad karma for myself. But they'll try on the Buddhist holy days, which is on the, depending on different people celebrate different ways, but on the new moon and the full moon days particularly, on those days they won't go out and fish. Because those are the holy days, they want to try to maintain the precepts, keep the precepts on those days. So they're trying to do the best they can. That's one way. But you know, where in our lives, the kind of lives of people here in this room, where does the first precept come into play so that it becomes something to reflect on and think about? One of the most common ones, which when I give a talk on the first precept, is people who garden. And what do you do about, or people have homes, what do you do about ants and termites? What do you do about the slugs in your garden? And people have come to me and asked, you know, what should I do? And I'm kind of like those monastics. I actually don't want to tell people what to do. But I love it that people come and ask. The fact that people will stop and consider whether, you know, should I kill the slugs or not? What should I do with these ants? What should I do? That to me is very important, that people are stopping and looking at the issue and then trying to think about it as intelligently and as deeply in their hearts as they can. The reason I don't want to answer the question for people is that it's very clear to me that I think we shouldn't kill. But then there are consequences to not killing the termites, right? If they destroy your home, that could have huge economic and social impacts for your family and yourself in ways that are very detrimental. And I don't want to be in a situation kind of, you know, to, you know, You know, I kind of feel uncomfortable making a decision for anybody. But I like it that people, I want to be supportive of people who make whatever decision they make. You know, but I want to encourage them to reflect and think about it. So it's one thing, you know, maybe slugs, snails, ants, and termites. But are there bigger issues that we have to face in our lives around the first precept? There are questions, for example, of abortion. There's question of euthanasia that some people have to face. There's questions of war. There's questions of capital punishment. That somehow some of these questions come very close at home for us, and some of them go quite far afield. This is maybe a little bit of a non sequitur, but a little bit. I'm just reminded of this, and I'm very touched by this memory. Many years ago, when we were in Palo Alto, I gave a talk around the death penalty, and the Buddhist idea of death penalty. Basically, Buddhism is against death penalty, as you can imagine. And there was some discussion in the room afterwards about the death penalty. And maybe some people are for, some against, or some of the different ethical questions around it. And this man stood up, and he said, you know, I've had to be on both sides of this question. Because my parents were murdered, and the person who murdered them was given the death penalty. But the person who murdered them was my brother. So that, you know, what do you do then? How do you negotiate that kind of question? Where is the empathy? Where's the understanding? What do we do? How do we understand these issues? One of the ways we understand some of these issues in Buddhism is understanding the possibility of people changing. The possibility of people having radical change of heart. So not to hold people back from that change, but rather the ability of people to change is so important in Buddhism. The ability of people to be liberated and become free, develop a loving heart, is so important that we want to kind of do whatever we can to make that possible, that change. In the movie Gandhi, maybe some of you saw 20 years ago, there was these riots in India, and there was I think it was a Hindu man. Is that who it was? Or a Muslim man? I forget, doesn't matter that much. A Hindu man who came to Gandhi and said, you know, during his riots, I killed some Muslims. What should I do? And Gandhi says to him, go find a Muslim orphan and raise him, but raise him as a Muslim. Quite something, huh? So again, I think Gandhi knew that something had to change inside the man. It wasn't enough just to he wasn't going to forgive him, but he had to do something. It had to be some atonement. He had to do something in the world because of what he'd done. He had to change. He had to kind of act in the world as a form of atonement. The classic example in Buddhism of being able to change oneself, in a radical way, is that story, the story of Angulimala. And Angulimala was a serial killer in the time of the Buddha. And the king was actually out with an army to try to capture Angulimala and to kill him because he was killing all these people. Before the king got to him, the Buddha got to him. And the Buddha converted him. Not only converted him, but Angulimala became a monk and became enlightened. But after he became a monk, the king, with his entourage of soldiers, came into the Buddha, to see the Buddha who was living in the woods, and said, in these woods, there's this mass murderer. We're looking for him. Have you seen him? And the Buddha says to him, oh, if you, and while the Buddha's sitting there, there's a man, I think, fanning the Buddha. It's a hot day, I guess. A monk, it's right behind the Buddha, fanning him. And the Buddha says, if you knew that Angulimala had become a monk, and had renounced his evil ways and was purifying his heart, what would you do then? And the king says something like, oh, in that case, I'd leave him alone. And then the Buddha says, well, this monk who's fanning me, this is Angulimala. And the king's hair stood up straight. He was so afraid of, you know, this guy. But here's an example of someone who radically was transformed and then was left alone. As a society in America, we tend not to have that kind of attitude of radical transformation as being something that could change someone enough that we want to leave them alone. There's a strong focus in America on punishment. If you do something, you need to be punished for what you've done. So in California, we have the death penalty. How do we relate to that? So for a Buddhist, I don't think any of you particularly are, you know, the executioners of San Quentin. But some of you might, at some point, might have to vote if this comes to, if California votes. Should we have a death penalty or not? And then it becomes a relevant issue, because then in some ways or other, you're participating. If you decide to vote yes for the death penalty, you're participating in that act of capital punishment. So there's a question people have to face and look at. And the question of euthanasia is one. Some of you maybe have had parents or loved ones that you had to be involved in to help decide what to do. Some people have animals they decide. People have come to me, not infrequently, asking me about what they should do with their animals. And, if their animals are sick and suffering, and should they put them to sleep is the word, right? And so people have to face these kind of dilemmas, what to do. So how do we negotiate these kinds of issues? The background for the first precept, or the kind of root kind of foundation for it, in my view, is compassion. The first precept is an expression of compassion. What takes precedent? Does a rule take precedent over compassion? So maybe it's not fair to kind of pose it that way, but is the precept or the virtue of not killing, does it trump compassion, or does compassion trump the idea of non-harm? Are there times when harming, when killing, creates greater good for an individual, for a society, for whatever? That is, it's appropriate sometimes to allow killing to happen, or actually to kill. Is it appropriate to do that? We have in America the idea of culling sometimes animals. If you get somehow the ecology gets imbalanced because you have too many deer, or too many something or other, and so we have this idea that you need to bring the ecology back into balance. So we justify then killing. How do we make these kinds of decisions? Is there times when compassion is more important than the idea of non-harming? In some schools of Buddhism, compassion trumps the idea of non-harming. There are times when, for example, when there's an awful tyrant in Tibet. There was a terrible tyrant that lived for a while. I guess he was killing lots of people. And there was a monk who went and killed him, because he felt that killing one tyrant was better than letting the tyrant kill 1,000 people. But once you start making choices like that, equations like that, it gets really what's called a slippery slope. And it's very easy to kind of justify war, justify all kinds of things once you start kind of crossing that line where you're allowing, some bigger idea to allow you to sacrifice the life of one person. So some Buddhist schools have very strict ideas. Some Buddhist schools put non-harming as the pinnacle, and other schools put compassion at the pinnacle. But how do we work with these? How do we work with it? So what I find the most inspiring, very inspiring, is when people are negotiating these questions, when they're thinking about them, when they're talking about them, when they're exploring them, trying not to take the received wisdom, not taking what their gut feelings are, but really engaging in it. So, for example, maybe that's not a good example, but Many years ago in Palo Alto, there was a woman who came to me and said she sometimes has to park in Palo Alto late at night, outside in the streets or in the parking lots there, and it's dark. And she felt very unsafe. And she wanted to know what I thought about her getting a gun. Again, I'd rather not have to answer those kinds of questions. But what I told her was that I don't think gun is a good idea, I said, but what I said was there's a very strong tendency in people to look for the easy, what's seemingly easy solution. And a gun is kind of an easy solution. And if a person is really dedicated to something like nonviolence, then maybe they should prepare themselves so they're ready for the difficult solutions. So maybe, as I told this one, maybe what you should do is maybe rather than getting a gun, maybe, which is, you know, you can go to Walmart and get one pretty quickly. Maybe rather than getting a gun, you should go do a self-protection course. And you can do like a 10-week self-protection course. And maybe that's a better way of adhering to that precept than just getting a gun. Getting a gun is kind of lazy. I've seen a little bit jumping there. I have sometimes yelled at my older son, who's now 7, because... It seems like, you know, it's not exactly done without any consideration. You know, it's not something I can do easily, but sometimes it seems like this is the only thing that's going to work to get his attention. It does get his attention. But then, what I've noticed is his younger brother, who's only 2, has heard that voice of mine. And guess who's trying it out? The 2-year-old's trying it out, and also the 7-year-old is trying it out in the 2-year-old. Without the kind of careful consideration that I've done. What are the conditions we're setting up? What can we, by the choices we make? And we want to create a society where people feel safe. We want to create a situation where the conditions are that we tend to move forward peacefulness. Or do we want to set up conditions where the obvious and easy thing is to go out and express our anger, or to live our anger, or get a gun, fight? When I was 18, 19, it was still during the time of the Vietnam War, and I was draftable. And it was a very real possibility that I was going to be drafted. And so, as with the other men in my college dorm, and we spent a lot of time debating war, nonviolence, pacifism. And I was I always took this extreme pacifist position. But pacifism for me didn't mean just being kind of doing nothing. Pacifism meant if I was going to follow through my beliefs, it meant standing in the street, standing up and protesting, but in nonviolent ways. Standing in front of the guns and saying, no, you can't do this. Putting my life on the line. I felt if I was going to live by my beliefs, I had to be able to put my life on the line. At the same time, I was very aware that I was afraid to die. And I felt I really couldn't follow through on my beliefs. And I really didn't like this, that I would have a belief that I didn't feel like I could follow through on. And so I was looking for some kind of way that I could actually let go of my fear so that if the time came, I could follow through on my nonviolent beliefs. And it was that time that I began casting about for some kind of practice that would help me with that training. And the one that I kind of settled on and found on was Buddhism. Somehow, there was no clear kind of thing that told me that, but somehow I felt in my reading of Buddhist practice was a solution to this kind of fear, so I could live my beliefs. And that was the beginning. It wasn't enough to get me seriously started in Buddhism, but that was my beginning of being interested in Buddhism, was somehow trying to deal with that fear so I could live my beliefs. So the idea of being living a nonviolent life is not one that simply doesn't have to only be a decision, yes, now I'm going to be try my best, but it's also going to involve a training ourselves, taking the time to develop ourselves in such a way that we can respond nonviolently to the world around us. I've known people who have done, a lot of people, because of living at San Francisco Zen Center, which was a very dangerous place for many decades when they're up there. I knew many people up there who were held up, knifed, shot. One person was killed in the neighborhood there. And it was interesting to watch the difference, or to hear the differences between the people who handled themselves really well when they were being mugged and those who didn't. And the ones who handled themselves really well said it was because of their years of meditation practice, they were able to stay calm and centered. And so because they were calm, they were able to know the right thing to do. And the right thing to do, each circumstance, was radically different. And some of them had, you know, it's really creative. So amazing creativity comes up, you know, when you're being mugged. And but really, you know, it's, who knows where the solutions, but because they've stayed calm, that creativity could arise. I'd love to tell you some of these stories, but running out of time. I'll tell you one story. When I was living in that neighborhood, this car came careening down the street in a noisy kind of way, veering from both sides of the street, and then made a kind of skidding turn and stop right in the intersection, just, I don't know, 10 yards above where I was standing. It was stopped in the intersection of Haight and Laguna. And out of this car tumbled this woman, kind of, you know, on all fours, kind of tumbling out of the car. And then these two big, you know, football player kind of guys came out, chasing after her. And she was definitely trying to get away from these big guys who were trying to get her. So it seemed like this shouldn't be. So I ran up there and stood between her and these two guys. She wasn't exactly running away, but she was trying to get away from them. And these two big guys, you know, took two steps towards me. So I took two steps back. And they took two steps forward, and I took two steps back, you know. But I didn't quite know what to do with these two big guys, but, you know, I felt kind of small. And I'm 6'1". And I didn't know, where is this going to go? And they wanted to get her somehow, do something with her. I mean, it wasn't clear exactly what was going on. And so while we were doing this dance, this other guy runs up, and he kind of gets in the middle of us all, and he says, you know, the guys are telling me, you have no business, this is our business, get out of our business. We're taking care of something here. You have no business being involved here. So this other guy runs up and he says, you know, if you were in the same shoes as this woman, I'd hope someone stopped for you and try to find out what was going on, try to stop. And when he said that to them, you know, kind of like, you know, put yourself in her shoes, then it just kind of diffused everything. And then there was a discussion, and everybody got calm, and there was a talking and sorting things out. I don't remember all the details, except the whole thing was diffused. Because that was the key that diffused it, when he kind of called on the empathy of putting them in the woman's shoes. And I thought that was quite a beautiful moment. So the issue of nonviolence as a training precept is an opportunity for us to look at really important issues in our lives. One of the issues is, what is most important for us? What's the most important activity? What's the most important purpose or intention or goal for human life? What's the most important thing for you? are some of the things you're willing to kill for, or willing to let other people kill for, as valuable as, you know, what's the value is being represented there? Another question is, what is your relationship to other people and other beings? What is that relationship? To really question that and look at it. That's what you're being asked to do here. What is it to be a self? What is it to be another? What is it to be self and other? What is it to be in contact with other people? To look at that very deeply. It's calling upon us to look at our motivations, our impulses, and the way we justify them. Do we justify when there's greed? Do we justify things by lofty, beautiful philosophy, or basically just greed? I want something, and I'm going to get rid of this. Push it away. Kill it. Or out of fear, or out of hate. Or do we have philosophies and beliefs of retribution, or of punishment, or of controlling and putting boundaries, or creating safety? And what are our beliefs around all these? And are these beliefs the most useful beliefs for us to have? So the precept of not to kill, the value, the virtue of nonviolence in Buddhism, I would suggest for all of you, is one that is asking you to reflect very deeply. And I don't know how you're going to decide some of these very important issues that some of you probably will have to face sooner or later, or have faced. But I really hope that it's something that's done with tremendously deep consideration, and a kind of consideration that's not just intellectual, but actually is somehow touching the depths of your heart. And that somehow that depth of your heart will show you the right thing to do, the appropriate thing to do. So, I hope that was okay. And I apologize for not taking time for questions, because I probably stirred up a lot of things, but that's the way it goes.